Welcome to Pain Talk, where we explore pain through a modern, science-based lens. If you're a healthcare provider or someone living with chronic pain, this podcast is for you. We break down how pain really works, why it can persist, and what helps the nervous system begin to feel safe again, because pain is real. But so is change.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to another Pain Talk podcast where we explore pain through a modern science-based lens. Today's episode is about a question I also hear very frequently is why don't pain medications work the way they used to? And I'm going to use a really common refrain. It depends. So let's unpack what's happening here and look at the science around very predictable experiences that often contribute to why medication stops working in the management of chronic pain. So the first thing that we need to understand is that chronic pain is very different than other forms of pain. So we really just need to understand that this is not just a single signal from your body saying, pay attention over here. Pain is actually a multidimensional experience created by your nervous system. Just think of it like this. Your body sends a message to your brain. The brain reviews it and goes, I wonder if this is dangerous. It also even goes as far to say, is it even safe right now to produce the sensation of pain, or do we need to get out of harm's way before the sensation really kicks in? I don't think we really realized, or many people don't realize, how complicated that experience is and how the brain decides to produce the sensation. So pain meds aren't just fighting pain. They're fighting a whole nervous system experience that might be running on high alert, which leads to one of the first reasons why pain stops working. Our nervous system actually changes and adapts around the pain, and it can actually become an overachiever in many ways. So here's something most people don't realize. Your nervous system is basically a student, a very hardworking student, sometimes too hardworking. When pain sticks around for a long time, and we're talking weeks, months, even years, your nervous system doesn't just experience pain, it starts to learn pain. So why would it learn pain? Because it matters. Pain is the sensation that Mother Nature instilled in all humans to keep us safe, to maximize our survival. Our nervous system learns to amplify pain because it feels that you're under threat, and it feels it needs to communicate that threat. And the way it does it is through the sensation of pain. So how does it know that? It's detecting different types of inputs that are coming into your body. The inputs are coming from what we see in our environment, our thoughts about the pain, any feelings we might have or reactions to the pain, or even other pressures that might be happening in our life. I mean, to the brain, all threat is the same. Your brain doesn't distinguish between threats that come from burning your hand on the stove versus, you know, if you're not able to pay your power bill. So that unconscious part of the brain that processes threat takes all of that information in, and depending on how much is going on, it can actually intensify that experience of pain. More threat equal more pain, less threat equal less pain. And that sensation gets louder because your brain wants you to do something about the threat it's detecting. And if pain continues long enough, your body can develop a pattern where the nervous system becomes really good at producing pain, and even much quicker at sort of sending out these pain signals and producing that sensation of pain. We call this sensitization. I like to call it amplification because that's exactly what it feels like. So most often when we're talking chronic pain, we're often talking about this amplification that happens within the central nervous system. The other term you'll often see is called central sensitization. That's when the brain and the spinal cord, that central nervous system, start turning up the volume knob on pain. So over time, something that used to feel like a mild irritation, like a 2 out of 10, now feels like a 7 out of 10. It's the same body. It's the same tissues, but you have a different nervous system setting. And this is often something that patients experience, especially when they present to a healthcare provider because their pain intensity is getting much worse. And so the healthcare provider may work up that patient's pain, meaning that they may repeat a CT scan or repeat some blood work. And literally what comes back is that there's no change. There's no medical explanation to explain the intensity of pain that the patient has experienced. Doesn't mean that that intensity is not real. It just means it's not about the tissue. It's about that volume knob that's happening within the central nervous system and the development of this central sensitization. It's like your nervous system has decided, hello, I will now be responding to everything like a five-alarm fire. And so medication that used to work for a 2 out of 10 really has no effect on that 7 on 10. And so this is one of the reasons why you see this change is how that, because of that change that's happening within the nervous system. So, and as we talked just briefly, actually, a few minutes ago, is that acute pain and chronic pain are very different beasts. Acute pain occurs after a sprain or a surgery, or if you have an inflammation or an infection going on in your body, it's mostly what's happening in the tissue. There's that injury, that inflammation, that our body will use pain until healing actually occurs. It's basically saying pain is telling us that we need to protect this area until we fix things. But chronic pain is different. It's a different type of beast, because over time, the nervous system changes using a process called neuroplasticity. So that's what allows sensitization to happen. So neuroplasticity is your brain's ability to adapt and rewire itself, which is usually a really good thing. And we used to think that this process was very limited, that as we got older, neuroplasticity was less likely to happen. But in fact, some of the studies now are telling us that we can actually cause neuroplasticity, or we can learn new things up until the day that we die. So our nervous system is changeable. It's adaptable. It will also adapt primarily to our protection and to our survival. So with chronic pain, the issue is less about what's happening in the tissue and more about what's happening in the nervous system itself, even though it still feels that pain is in the body. Now, don't get me wrong. If you feel pain in your knee, your back, your shoulder, it makes perfect sense to assume, well, something must be damaged there because you feel it there. But in chronic pain, what's often happening is that the central nervous system is firing off pain signals even when the tissues aren't in danger anymore. Pain-generating neural circuits in the brain and spinal cord are starting to become more overactive because of that process of neuroplasticity, and they can start triggering that pain system more easily. So the pain receptors in the body become more reactive, the brain becomes more protective, and the whole system starts behaving like it's stuck in a high alert mode. Basically, your nervous system develops a habit of protection. And emotions play a bigger role than people think. Here's another important piece. When you're in pain for a long time, you naturally start feeling things like fear, frustration, anger, anxiety, and avoidance. So it makes sense because everything that you're doing doesn't seem to address the pain. What you once used, tools that you once used that seemed to kind of calm the pain, suddenly are not effective anymore. And listen, these reactions to the pain are not a sign of weakness. It makes sense that we would act with this frustration. But unfortunately, what happens is that the brain interprets those reactions as meaning more threat. But these are all normal reactions. They're human reactions. But the nervous system, as we talked, read these emotions like information or like gasoline being poured into a fire, because your brain is constantly asking, is this situation dangerous? So if you're afraid to move, avoiding activity, or you're feeling constantly frustrated because the pain is not changing and maybe getting worse, your brain may be interpreting that as, okay, wow, this must be serious. We better keep the pain alarm system running. So the emotional response, completely understandable, can unintentionally reinforce the pain system by signaling more threat. And your nervous system, it loves threat. Threat is its favorite hobby. It is designed to detect it, look for it, and respond to it. So here's what's also important to know. You can't control when the sensation of pain comes up, just like you can't control any other sensation like anxiety or a panic sensation. You can only control your reaction to it. And this is really key when we look at how we help individuals who are living with complex pain, or even help ourselves understand how we can start to make progress, is that we want to look at our reaction to pain. Because if our reaction is a fear reaction or an avoidance reaction or a frustration reaction or an anger reaction, the brain will interpret that as more threat. This is a tool, where a really effective tool called somatic tracking that we briefly talked about in the last podcast can become really important. We're going to talk more about somatic tracking throughout the podcast that we're doing. But for now, just remember that more threat equal more pain, less threat equal less pain. So the other thing that starts to happen with medication is this really important concept called tolerance. What it means basically is that your body gets used to the medication. And this is really classic with certain types of medications. So medications like opioids or narcotics, medications like cannabinoids, medications like benzodiazepines. And that really is not something that the patient is making happen. It's really about the how these medications are metabolized and how our body gets used to them. So this happens with many medications, as I mentioned. And what it means over time is that the effect that your medication, so patients who are using opioids to manage their pain, the benefit that they're getting is that pain management. Over time, and this really will happen within days, is that what starts to happen is that that dose of medication doesn't seem to be as effective and you're getting less relief. And this happens to 100% of people who are taking medications on a regular basis. And that includes patients who are taking these medications at the end of life. So tolerance happens 100% of the time if you're actually using these medications on a regular basis. It's like a cup of coffee. At first, one cup makes you feel like you could run a marathon. Later, one cup just makes you feel like maybe slightly less like you're dragging your butt in the morning. Same concept. But and so what's happening is your receptors are adapting, you're developing tolerance to that medication. So if you've been using it repeatedly over time, your body will say, okay, I know this trick, I'm not impressed, give me more, or I'll give you more of the same, more pain. Certain medications like opioids can literally take you hostage, not because of your body, it's because of how they work. So there's a really good article that was recently published by Dr. David Jerlink that I'm going to post in the notes later on when this gets set up. And so it's through the Canadian Journal of Medicine. And it's really interesting because he really gets into the importance of understanding the pharmacokinetics, or how these drugs actually metabolize and are eliminated in our body, and how it actually in the chronic pain population can actually set them up for failure. And it's one of the reasons why opioids generally are not that effective. It has nothing to do with the patient. Generally, these medications are really effective if you're managing acute pain over a short period of time, but also if you're managing a patient with life-limiting illness, like cancer, is that these medications are extremely important. But almost in all of those patients, we actually have to adjust those medications because of tolerance. And it might be shocking for a lot of people to realize that many of our patients who are living with life-limiting illnesses actually end up in an opioid called methadone, primarily because methadone is a really important opioid analgesic that helps to prevent a wind-up effect within the central nervous system. And this is really a complication that can sometimes happen from the use of opioids, which is called opiate-induced pain. The other thing that causes medication to stop working is recognizing that our own body's pain pharmacy can start to burn out. So often the medications that we're bringing into our body work in conjunction with our own pharmacy that we have in our body. And so they kind of play on each other. And so here's what's really kind of interesting and kind of wild, right? So your brain naturally produces its own pain relief chemicals, including endorphins. Everybody hears about endorphins. We hear about dopamine, serotonin, and norepinephrine. All these neurochemicals can actually help calm pain signals. But if you're under a lot of stress, not sleeping well, depressed, anxious, or in constant pain, your brain's pain relief system can start to underperform. It's really common for patients when they go see naturopaths to be often told that they're adrenally suppressed, because this is where we're making a lot of these chemicals that are very important for our fight or flight response. And most of our patients who are living with pain are actually in a constant stress state. And so they deplete their adrenals of these chemicals. So what happens is that your brain's pain relief system can start to underperform. Your internal pharmacy becomes short-staffed. And if your brain's pain system is struggling, medication often feel weaker because the medicine is no longer doing its job. But it's not even getting any backup from the nervous system now. And so here's where pain gets a little sneaky too. It's kind of fascinating, especially when you look at dopamine and dopamine's role not only in helping us to move towards positive things in our life, it can actually help us avoid things that are negative in our life, and actually can help reinforce pathways like the chronic pain pathways, or these pain-generating neural pathways that develop. Pain processing doesn't happen in isolation. It's deeply connected to the brain's learning and reward systems, the same system involved in motivation, habit building, and decision making. So when pain signals arrive in the brain, they don't just knock on the door, they walk straight into a party that's already happening, where chemicals like endorphins, endogenous cannabinoids, and dopamine are hanging out. So we usually hear about dopamine as the pleasure chemical, felt good, let's do it again messenger, but neuroscience has also caught dopamine doing double duty. And this is really important. And this is really just recent research showing dopamine is also deeply involved in the brain's threat detection and avoidance systems. In other words, dopamine doesn't just reward you for moving towards something good. It also rewards you for moving away from something bad like pain. Avoiding pain can be rewarding, literally. When you move away from pain, stop an activity, rest, avoid a position, dopamine pathways can activate. Your brain basically says, nice move, that felt safer. And that dopamine release reinforces the behavior from a survival standpoint. That sounds brilliant. If you touch a hot stove and pull your hand away, dopamine helps lock in that lesson. Well done, nervous system. But where things get really tricky, the problem comes up when the system stays turned on long after the danger has passed. So it's no longer about protecting or healing tissue. What happens is that in chronic pain, it's the ongoing avoidance can teach the brain that pain itself is dangerous. So rather than seeing avoidance as protective in acute pain, in chronic pain, the ongoing avoidance actually reinforces these pain-generating neural pathways, and the brain starts to even fear pain more. And the brain is a really quick learner. It knows what it wants, how it's going to work, what's going to help it. So each time movement is avoided, the nervous system quietly reinforces a fear-based circuit. Pain equals threat. Avoidance equals safety. Pain equals threat. Avoidance equals safety. And dopamine unintentionally helps wire that lesson in. Over time, this fear avoidance learning strengthens neural pathways associated with threat. The brain becomes better and faster at predicting pain. And ironically, that increased protection can increase pain sensitivity, not reduce it. So dopamine may contribute to short-term pain relief through avoidance, but also the long-term persistence of pain when fear and avoidance become habitual. And so it's not that dopamine is doing something wrong. It's problem is that dopamine is doing its job too well. So the big takeaway from this is that pain isn't just about tissues or damage. It's about learning. It's about prediction. It's about motivation. It's about safety. And when the brain repeatedly learns that pain equals danger and avoidance equals reward, the pain system can stay active long after healing has occurred. Understanding this helps shift the conversation away from what's broken about me towards what the nervous system has learned and how do we help it unlearn something that is holding us back and maybe learn something new that's helping us to make progress. So from a clinical perspective, this reframes chronic pain in a really important way. Pain behaviors, especially avoidance, are not simply patient choices or compliance issues. They are learned, reinforced responses driven by the brain's reward and threat systems. When avoidance reduces pain or perceived danger, dopamine reinforces that strategy, even when tissues are no longer at risk. Over time, this strengthens fear-based neural circuits and increases pain sensitivity through this process called central sensitization. What that means clinically is that pain does not need ongoing tissue damage to persist. Fear, avoidance, and safety-seeking behaviors can maintain pain through neuroplastic learning. So it's the changing and adapting around protection. Interventions that focus only on tissue pathology may miss the primary driver of symptoms in chronic pain states. So when we continue to apply our treatment and our focus on tissue, we're actually missing. And so what's really interesting about this concept is that the more we are trying, and naturally it makes sense that we're going to do this, right? This is the hard part that's really, it just makes so much sense when we understand the biological mechanism here for chronic pain, is that if you're dealing with acute pain, it makes sense to use therapies and treatments that help to move the patient slightly away from pain while their tissue heals. So we want to actually promote a tolerance of pain while that tissue heals. So we're not trying to eliminate it. We're trying to decrease the intensity so that the tissue can heal and people can move. Whereas with chronic pain, when we start using these therapies to actually diminish pain or promote the avoidance of pain, what we're actually doing is the opposite. We're reinforcing these neural pathways. So if you think about things like medication, so if my goal when I bring in a medication to help manage pain is to actually get rid of pain or to lower it to such an intensity that the patient is not going to be impacted, then what I'm doing is promoting fear and avoidance of pain. And so this is where it starts to kind of cross over, and we actually can make patients worse. And I think the literature is actually showing this, is that we don't really have, and there's been a couple of really good papers that have demonstrated this. Dr. Tina Koronik and her group out of Alberta in 2022 produced a paper that really looked at how a lot of these medication-based tools that we're using were actually not improving the quality of life for patients, because what they were doing is moving patients more away from pain, reinforcing these pathways. There's actually another paper that's going to be coming out soon by Dr. Bussey and his group, who I'm hoping to interview in March, where they looked at specific interventional therapies of the spine, looking at, you know, interventions involving, you know, axial spine pain as well as radicular. And what they were finding is that we weren't really actually improving the quality of life for patients or helping them make progress, even though we spend a huge amount of money within healthcare to promote these therapies. And I think sometimes what happens is that we can keep patients stuck in maladaptive coping because they really don't know what else they can do. But I think the science has advanced enough that we can start to recognize there are some really effective tools that we'll talk about in another podcast. But somatic tracking is the one that jumps out to me most at this time. So to provide effective care for patients, we really need to help reduce the threat within the nervous system and gradually retrain movement and exposure to pain in a way that feels safe to the patient. And also trying to address these strong beliefs and expectation and fear around pain that have been there for a long time. And we also need to support patients in learning that movement can be safe again, not all at once, but progressively. And this really highlights an important point. And I stress to healthcare providers all the time, one of the worst things that we can do is to send a patient to physiotherapy whose nervous system has already learned that physiotherapy makes them worse. Even though we know that physiotherapy is not causing damage to the person's tissue, their nervous system, however, and these pain-generating neural circuits have actually linked that experience to the physiotherapy to worsening pain. So these patients will actually get pain even before they go to physiotherapy. And all we're doing by forcing them to go is to really to further sensitize their pain system. And the same thing with workman's compensation, some of the techniques that they use, if anything, what we're doing is we're sensitizing the patient's nervous system. And most patients, not all patients, but a majority are starting to get worsening pain, even though there's not more damage happening within the body. The important thing is that treatment isn't just about fixing structures. It's about updating the brain's predictions, shifting learning away from fear and avoidance, and helping the nervous system recalibrate what is truly dangerous versus what is simply, you know, a nervous system that's changing and adapting. When providers and patients alike understand pain is a learned, modifiable process, rather than a fixed signal of damage, it opens the door to more compassionate conversations with the patient, better patient engagement, and more effective long-term outcomes. Another reason why medications sometimes stop working is that the pain itself starts to change. So initially when medication gets introduced, it often gets introduced after an injury, illness, or surgery. So often that is what we call nociceptive pain or acute pain. There often are inflammatory components to that type of pain. So medications like anti-inflammatories can be very, very effective. But what happens when that nervous system starts to change and adapt, it's no longer about inflammation, even though it feels like inflammation is still occurring in that tissue. And that's part of how the brain hangs on to the memory of that pain experience. Your brain will encode experiences around pain that are really impactful, especially if they're associated with fear or anger or frustration. That's just the way it's designed. You might be using medications like acetaminophen or an anti-inflammatory, which were very effective. But as the nervous system and the pain system start to change and adapt, we actually get into what we call a typical neuropathic pain or a nocioplastic pain. So this is much more difficult to treat. And as a palliative care physician, I can attest to that. It's probably one of the most challenging types of pain to manage with medications alone. And what makes the chronic pain, nociplastic pain, more difficult is that often if you, there's a fine line between how you manage the medication, meaning that if I bring in medication in a situation for a patient living with chronic pain, my goal is not to reduce their pain. My goal is to actually take them from a high intensity pain to a moderate intensity so that they can bring in new skills. Because it's not about the motivation or willpower of this population that we talked about previously. It's about the skills they need. They need to understand what chronic pain is, but they also need these new skills that are going to help them make progress that are very specific to chronic pain. That shift in sort of that biological mechanism becomes really important why medication stops working. And generally, opiate analgesics, in my experience, often when you're dealing with a neuropathic pain syndrome, is that many patients end up in a very high dose, and often all end up with these complications called opiate-induced pain or opiate-induced withdrawal, which also drives the pain. So all these complications that are no fault of the patient, but then we start to sensitize that pain system even more. The other thing that starts to happen, why pain starts to change in chronic pain, are the normal physiological adaptions that happen when we experience pain. And I call these pain-generating behaviors. So it's normal and natural when we're experiencing pain for the muscles to get tight to protect those painful areas, right? So if you've got low back pain, those muscles are going to get tight in the low back. If the pain lasts a long time, those muscles are going to learn to stay tight. So there's neuroplasticity again. So those muscles learn to stay tight. So muscles that learn to stay tight are muscles that are working really hard. So they'll start to burn. They'll start to fatigue. They'll start to get spasm and sort of twitching because of the fatigue. So you'll see that very commonly. And how you can make that link for someone who's living with chronic pain is that when you go lay down, that muscle tension starts to ease a bit. It doesn't go away completely because those muscles are exhausted. It's no different than if I'm leaving the gym after a really hard workout. My muscles are going to communicate that. So, but definitely the intensity of pain is much less. The other thing that starts to happen, so those nociceptors or those pain receptors in those areas are going to communicate. They're going to send off a pain signal. And because you've got an amplified pain system, that intensity of pain is going to be much higher than the average person. So someone who's living with chronic pain, on average, their pain intensity is around 5 or 6 in my experience, but it can vary day to day. So their 0 may be a 5 or 6. And so when they're getting an increase in pain, they're going off the scale, if we're going to use a pain scale, which is not the greatest way to assess the pain in someone who's living with chronic pain. One way I kind of adapt the pain scale, because sometimes it's the only tool that we have, especially in the emergency room, is I often will see a pain scale as a suffering scale. So 15 on 10 pain is really a 15 on 10 suffering, so that I can try to bring in all of the different dimensions or threats that that individual's body may be experiencing, not just the biological threat. I want to look at any kind of a social threat, psychological threat, or a spiritual threat. I mean, there's so many different things that can be. And what's really interesting is that it's not something that the patient is intentionally making happen. What's happening is that the part of the brain that detects this is not that sophisticated. It's also not that complicated. It really is an unconscious part of the brain that is designed to keep us safe. That's its function. It's always looking for threat. It enjoys the threat. So what's important about understanding how pain is changing is that it's not really about the medication so much as it is how our nervous system is changing and adapting. So it's less about what's happening in the tissue and more about how that nervous system are changing and adapting, as was mentioned. So what medications can and can't do in chronic pain? So many medications we use for chronic pain do act on the central nervous system. But here's the key shift in thinking, and I think we highlighted this. The goal is not to eliminate pain. The goal is to turn the volume down, to take pain from a high, overwhelming intensity where your brain is feeling too much danger, down to something more manageable, finding just enough matters. Bear with me. I'm going to try a little Goldilocks analogy here. Why just enough matters? When pain intensity is extremely high, the brain gets stuck in survival mode. Learning shuts down, curiosity shuts down, change shuts down. But when the pain is reduced to a moderate level, something important happens. The brain becomes capable of understanding pain differently. It becomes capable of learning new coping and movement strategies, updating its threat predictions, and gradually becomes less protective. That's where real long-term change begins. So if we push the medications too far, on the other hand, what happens is that we can generate another problem. So too much medication can lead to mental fog, sedation. It can increase an individual's fall risk and reduce confidence in movement. So what often happens is that all of these different factors can increase fear and avoidance of pain, which sends the brain a familiar message: this must be dangerous, stay protected. Different pathways, same threat signal. So the more vulnerable we make our patients by creating mental fog, the more threat the brain is going to feel. And when a patient has a fall, especially someone living with chronic pain, the brain encodes that with a lot of intensity. And so the patient unconsciously can start to develop a fear of falling, which also reinforces the pathway that I can't move because I don't feel safe moving. So there is a nervous system sweet spot around medication. So here's the balance we're aiming for. Too little support, the brain feels overwhelmed by threat. Too much support, the brain feels unsafe in a different way. Just enough support, the brain feels safe enough to learn. So we're looking for that moderate to low intensity. And learning is the whole point, because chronic pain improves not when we silence the nervous system, but we can help it feel safe enough to update what it has learned. You see where this is going. Medications aren't the enemy. They are a tool, but they're not the solution. Used thoughtfully, they can create the conditions where the brain can engage, can adapt, and can relearn safety. And that's where meaningful, lasting change can actually happen. So finding that sweet spot is really important. So we're almost done here. It seems to be going on for a long time. But this is another reason I'm going to give you here now is why medications stop working. And I think sometimes we think that medications are, when we take them, they're just, they're going in our body, but we're not really appreciating the different types of metabolic pathways that the medication has to go through. So in order to have a really, not to get a lot of side effects or not a lot of interactions, you have to have a really healthy liver and healthy kidneys. So these are really important when we're metabolizing medication. So your body metabolizes medication using these different enzyme systems in your liver and filtration system in your kidneys. But those systems can change, especially as we get older. So a lot of times patients can end up on medications for a long time. There can be some hormonal changes that are happening in our body, especially around menopause. There can be some significant weight change, either an increase or a loss of weight. There can also be other medications that are coming in and influence how the medications you're taking are metabolized. There can be other substances like alcohol that come in and mix. And alcohol can be one of the most dangerous substances when you mix it with medications that work in the central nervous system. So they create this effect called a synergistic effect. So it can increase your risk of respiratory depression, increase your risk of falls, and even worse, in some situations, especially around the combination of benzodiazepines or with opioids, it can actually contribute to death. And in fact, in Nova Scotia, alcohol is one of the most common substances that we see that gets mixed in with other substances that contributes to overall mortality in the province. There can also be things like an underlying illness. So you've been fine, but all of a sudden you pick up another medication, or sorry, pick up another illness, or even get diagnosed with a serious illness like cancer, which can actually change the metabolism of these medications. There can also be genetic factors that are also contributing. So the same medication with these different factors might now be broken down too fast, not absorbed well, or even processed differently. This is why two people can take the same pill and have totally different results. Your body chemistry is not a set it and forget it appliance. It's more like a phone with constant software updates. Sometimes the updates help, sometimes they ruin everything. The other thing that we talked about previously about chronic pain in particular and why medications might not work is that there can be all kinds of other threats that are happening in your space that can actually be making the pain louder. So it's important to recognize stress and trauma, basically turn up the volume. So here's the part that most people hate hearing, but it's real science. So stress changes pain. When your body is stressed, your nervous system shifts into survival mode. Your brain becomes more protective. Pain will become much louder and your muscles will tighten. So your immune system can also become more active. We often think of immune system function as inflammation, swelling. So that would be your normal response to an injury, illness, or surgery. So we need our immune system to go there and fight these demons, right? So every day our immune system is asked to do some amazing things. And so we need to keep that immune system healthy. But what can also happen if you're feeling a lot of stress, and especially if the pain is persistent, is that your immune system can actually be in constant surveillance mode, which is means that it's never at rest. It's constantly looking for the threat because that's its job. It may not be causing inflammation, but it's staying very, very active. So its main job is to find threats, destroy threats, and protect you. And when your body perceives this ongoing threat, physical or emotional, your immune system shifts into that surveillance mode, as I was talking about. That means it stays more alert, more reactive, and more ready to respond. Now, this is different from what happens with something like a broken bone or infection that we talked about, or a cut that needs healing. In those cases, the immune system is targeted, time-limited, and designed to resolve once the problem is dealt with. But chronic stress changes the rule. With ongoing stress, the immune system doesn't get the same clear-off switch. There's strong evidence showing that chronic pain stress increases the risk of long-term conditions like heart disease, diabetes, and chronic pain. So why does it do it? Because stress hormones like cortisol and adrenaline keep the body in a state of heightened tension and readiness. It's also stimulating these really important cells called glial cells that are really important for the health of our nervous system. So when they're constantly being triggered, what they can do is start to contribute to some of these changes. And one particular group of glial cells called microglia have been associated with the development of chronic pain. So when stress fuels pain from the top down, so if you're overwhelmed, exhausted, grieving, anxious, or completely burned out, pain medications may not work the way you expect. It's not because they're doing something wrong, but because the pain system is being fueled from the top down, from the brain, nervous system, and immune system working together. This is not all in your head. Let's be very clear about this. Pain being influenced by the brain does not mean it's imaginary. It means the brain is doing what it's designated to do, process danger and protection. The brain is not outside the pain system. It is the pain system. The big truth, when stress stays high, the nervous system and immune system stay alert. And when those systems stay alert, pain can become louder, stickier, and hard to shut off. So yes, stress can absolutely turn pain into a full-time job. But the good news is that anything that reduces threat can restore safety and support regulation, both emotionally, physically, and socially. So it becomes a really important part of how we help patients manage pain. Because helping the body feel safe again isn't optional, it's really important and it's biological. Another part of what makes medication not work effectively is when you become very sleep deprived. And so just talking briefly about sleep, because I'll do a whole podcast on sleep. It is really an underrated miracle drug. Sleep is so important from many different perspectives. If you're not sleeping well, your brain's pain control systems are starting to weaken. Studies show that poor sleep can increase pain sensitivity, increase inflammation surveillance, reduce your pain tolerance, reduce medication effectiveness. It doesn't allow that that threat detection system to replenish, you know, your adrenaline, cortisol, noradrenaline, all those really important neurochemicals that we need to make our day and to fight our stress response. So if you're running on 4 or 5 hours of broken sleep, this can also happen with medications that are short acting, such as benzodiazepine and opioids, through no fault of your own. So what I have learned in my experience working with patients with chronic pain is that oftentimes when they do find a drug like an opioid effective, and then it starts to lose its effectiveness, they often kind of feel more fear around that. So they're not really understanding what's happening. And so you will see a higher than normal burden of short acting medication. And so I think what's happening there, if we look at some of the studies that have been done on this, is that we know that the brain map starts to change, that the brain itself becomes very focused on the pain, but also starts to fear worsening pain. And so when you have a therapy that actually is working, so a short acting medication, and you can feel the onset, that almost sends a signal to the brain that there is some relief on the way. And so when you're developing tolerance, that kind of makes you feel really panicky. And the other thing that often happens, if we try and switch it to long acting, Most patients I find don't like that effect because they can't feel it working. But what starts to happen is that that short acting effect of the medication, so you take the medication, 3 or 4 hours later, you're actually in more pain. Or if you've gone to sleep, you're waking up in 3 to 4 hours and have to take more medication. That's an effect of the medication. So that's called withdrawal mediated pain. So sometimes we can counteract that by using a long acting medication at nighttime, but it really takes a lot of talking with patients and helping them understand what's actually happening so that we can address that really important problem. So the medication can actually disrupt the sleep. It can also contribute to, especially if it's really sedating, is obstructive sleep apnea. So even though it may appear that you're sleeping, you actually have very ineffective sleep. But we're going to talk about those things in another podcast. So what's happening here is that your pain meds are basically walking into a battle with no armor. So they're just really not helping. So sleep is not a luxury. It's really a pain management tool, very important. The pain memory effect. So when pain lasts long enough, the brain can develop a pain memory. And that's really what these pain-generating neural circuits are. Not in a dramatic, your brain is haunted way, but in a neurological wiring way. The brain creates pathways that become easier to activate. So pain becomes a default setting, not just a reaction. That doesn't mean that pain is imaginary. It just means that the nervous system is stuck in a loop. And medications alone often struggle to interrupt these loops. And in some medications, especially opiate analgesics, they can actually reinforce these loops. So, okay, that's a lot of information. So what can you do? How can we make this better? So if the pain meds aren't working like they used to, what do you do now? So here's a few science-backed options that can actually help. You want to make sure that the expectations you have around the medications are realistic. So remember when we talked about how the goal of the medication is not to get rid of pain, but to take you from that high-intensity pain to moderate so that we can bring in new skills. So that we might need to reframe what we think the medication should do. Now, for acute pain, the medication, it's realistic to think that it's actually not going to be needed for a long time because the pain is going to go away. But remember, chronic pain is a different beast. The other thing that can be helpful, especially if you're finding that the medication is not working, is to ask yourself a really simple question. Where is the threat coming from? Because remember, pain is a messenger. It's also a threat detector. So it's not just the biological piece. It's not about tissue. It's about other threats in your environment. So are there financial pressures? Are there social pressures? You know, are you no longer getting along with your spouse? You know, are there concerns about being able to pay your bills? Like those things are very realistic and have a huge impact on pain. And often medications are not going to take away those. And if there are disruptions in relationships, often that cannot be medicated. That requires a real listening and leaning in. We need to understand what the medication is trying to do, and then we need to look at it realistically. Do I have a realistic expectation of what it can do? But also, have I really looked at where the threats are coming from that are contributing to my pain experience? Sometimes as well, the nervous system responds better when treatment isn't always the same. So this is where we often talk about, you know, multimodal therapies for the management of chronic pain, is that medication cannot be the only tool. And in fact, it's considered to be one of the weakest tools in the management of chronic pain. When we look at the tools that are most effective, is that it's often understanding what's going on. So the pain education tools, there's also the physical activity tools. How do we help people develop a movement strategy? And I'll do a whole podcast on that because that is so important. And movement isn't what we think. It's not send them to physio and let's just see them getting active. It requires a lot of evaluation, and a lot of checking in, and a lot of safety appraisals as well. So we'll take some time and do that. The third thing that actually has been shown to be very effective are these psychological tools, somatic tracking, pain reprocessing therapy. And I've done a few podcasts on this, but these are new skills, right? So it's not something that's going to come intuitively or naturally. We have to learn that skill. And that can be really frustrating because when we are living with pain and we find something that may be effective, we almost get a little impatient. We want it to work really quickly, but the more intense we come at it, the worse it's more likely to cause more pain in the end. So, but exploring other types of therapies that might be effective or add into what we're doing. So I think that's really important. And it's also recognizing that the management of chronic pain is really about skill. It's not about interventional pill or pills that are going to make the difference. It's really about new skills. We also need to manage stress like it matters, as well as sleep, because it does matter, and recognizing that we need to identify those threats. I'm just going to close now because it's gone. We've been kind of talking about this a little bit long. I guess in closing, I would say, so why doesn't pain medication work like it used to, which is really common? So the first thing I want to say is to normalize that's really predictable. Like, and I always will say to patients, expect medications to stop working. It's because the body is changing. The nervous system is learning. It's adapting. So your tissue may still be the same, but that nervous system and these pain-generating neural circuits are starting to amplify the system. So that brain is adapting. The pain that you have is evolved. It's transitioned from something that maybe had been tissue-based to more central nervous system-based. And sometimes that internal chemistry just decides to switch things up without you even asking. So pain meds aren't failing because you're imagining things. They may be failing because your pain has changed and your treatment needs to change too. And if you've been frustrated, unheard, or scared, you're not alone. Pain is complicated, but you are not broken. So we're going to end it today. And if you like this episode, share it with someone who you think might benefit. And as always, be kind to your nervous system. It's doing the best it can in this moment. But as Maya Angelou said, when we know better, we do better. If it's learned to become overprotective, it's doing the best it can in that moment. But it will get better once it knows better. So I'll see you next time. And thanks for being patient and listening.